There never was a TV network that was just started by people as opposed to media companies. We were the outliers. A lot of the other programmers were rooting for our demise, particularly MTV, which we actually turned into a positive for us because I love sticking them in the butt with a pin, and they would react to it. We started running things on the network, on Talk Soup, going, and here's a thing that's on that music channel, whatever it's called. And well, what's the M stand for? Oh, it's your mother's TV. Yeah. And they would just get so angry. We just attacked them.
Welcome to the Seven Hats Podcast. My name is Yuval Selig, and I've been on the entrepreneurial roller coaster for over 20 years. I've experienced it all throughout my journey, the grind, burnout, failure, and ultimately, success. The turning point for me was realizing that building a successful company is meaningless if you neglect the other significant areas of your life. So today, I'm inviting you to join me on an adventure through those seven areas, what I call the seven hats. Every week, my guests and I will drop valuable insights and pearls of wisdom, helping, motivating, and inspiring you to get your seven hats in order and deliver real impact with meaning. So let's get going.
Hey there, Seven Hatters. Today, we're diving into the extraordinary world of media innovation with Larry Namer, a visionary entrepreneur who revolutionized how the world consumes entertainment. Larry's journey epitomizes the entrepreneurial spirit we celebrate on this show. From his humble beginnings as an underground cable splicer in Brooklyn to founding the iconic E! Entertainment Television Network. In this episode, we're focusing on hats 1, 6, and 7, the soul, the philanthropist, and the seeker, as we explore Larry's incredible path from the streets of Coney Island to building a global media empire across America, Russia, and China. Larry's story is all about seeing opportunities where others don't, refusing to follow the crowd, and continuously reinventing himself every 7 years. We'll unpack how he launched a TV network with just $2.5 million when the industry standard was about $60 to $100 million, and his experience working with Vladimir Putin in Russia, and how cooking became his form of therapy throughout his career challenges. So, if you're curious about the mindset that creates success in unexpected ways, you want to learn from a media pioneer who shaped pop culture globally, or just love hearing about perseverance and creative thinking, sit back and let's warmly welcome Larry to the Seven Hats. Larry, welcome to the Seven Hats.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's going to be fun.
It is. You know, I've been looking forward to this conversation because, quite frankly, your journey is the epitome of what we talk about on the show. Reinvention, perseverance, and really creating something from nothing, from working underground as I believe a cable splicer in Brooklyn to revolutionizing global pop culture with the E! Channel, one of my favorites. Your story is about breaking the mold and refusing to follow the crowd. You didn't just build a media empire. You redefined the way that the world consumes entertainment. And now with your book, which we'll plug multiple times, Never Follow the Crowd, you're giving us a behind-the-scenes look at how you've continuously reinvented yourself every pretty much 7 years. So whether it was launching a TV network against all odds, building a media empire in Russia and in China, or mixing your love for storytelling with your passion for cooking, is my passion, in the most unconventional biography that I've ever read. So today we're going to unpack the lessons, the pivots, and the moments that shaped your journey. Because if there's anyone who knows how to create success, I think in unexpected ways, it's you. But first, before we get into all of that, the Seven Hatters, our community, they love a great backstory. So let's take it back to Brooklyn. We want to know what those early days were like and how they shaped you in the way you see the world today. So Larry, the first question is always, where were you born? And we know Brooklyn, right? And how was your childhood like?
My parents were, second generation immigrants, and dad was from Turkey, mother was from Siberia. So we grew up in not trendy Brooklyn, but, what's still the hood in Brooklyn, Coney Island. We didn't know that we were different than everybody else, and we thought everybody else lived the same way. And in later years, we discovered we were poor. But, childhood was great. My dad grew up in that same neighborhood, and he He was a bit of a sports hero there. So, that was interesting, going to watch my dad play softball and football and do all of that. And then eventually reaching the age where they let me play, and playing against my dad was always kind of interesting because he used to kill me. But first getting the family to go to college, not that I had a choice. It was, my parents were dead set. You were going to go to college whether you want to or not. They were pretty strict, and that shaped me a lot with things like, it was a very multiracial neighborhood. So we got to know people of all different colors and sizes and stuff like that. And they were just our neighbors and stuff. And so I went to college. I got a degree in economics. Why? I'm not sure. But I quickly found out there weren't a lot of jobs for economists out there. So I took what I thought was going to be a temporary job until I figure out what I do with myself. So I got a job. Somebody I knew was in the Electrical Workers Union. And they said, oh, we organize this thing. It's called cable TV. I'm not sure what it is, but I don't think anybody will ever pay for television, but go see the shop steward there and tell them the union sent you. And so I did that, and they gave me a job as I wasn't even the splicer. I was the assistant underground splicer in Manhattan. So literally my job was every day I would go under the streets of Manhattan and put wires together and with the cockroaches and the rats and stuff. And they paid me $90 a week, which I thought was kind of good, but realized after they wasn't so good. So that's really where I started getting involved in the cable business way back then, but from the side of putting wires together.
Any siblings?
Yeah, I've got a younger sister, younger brother.
So sister and brother. And so how was that dynamic growing up? Did you have a competitive nature about you? Were they also interested in the same things you were? What did your parents want from you guys? I know they want you to go to college. And by the way, I'm an economics major too. I don't know why either, but yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. My sister is 4 years younger, and it was always kind of weird. I was always looking for what's next and what would be, and stuff. My sister, on the other hand, when she was 12, she was already cutting out pictures from magazines of what her living room would look like when she got married. So our goals in life were very different. My brother, who I'm very close with today, was 11 years younger. So we really didn't grow up together. And, I ended up getting married and out of the house, and he was still like a little kid. But in later years, we came together where, we found all this common ground, and we're still very close. And both of them live in New Jersey now.
Awesome. So starting with the early years, because you spoke about that early grind, I think that's where foundation is built. Same thing with me going into a consulting firm and working late hours, trying to figure my life out. You started, as you said, as the assistant underground splicer working in New York. And that's a tough kind of hands-on job. What did those early days teach you about, because you're going to need this as you continue evolving, what did they teach you about resilience and problem solving back then?
Well, I mean, for me, it was, people say, how did you do that? But my dad worked for Pepsi Cola. He used to drive the truck. And literally since I'm 12 years old, my dad would, on weekends would take me to help him unload the truck. So I was used to like laboring and stuff like that. So it wasn't so unusual. It was like lift Pepsi Cola cases or splice wires together. It wasn't a heck of a lot different. But I started to just kind of get lost. It was great because you go on the 8:30 in the morning, you go on the ground, nobody sees you again until 5 o'clock, and then you go home. But I started to get really intrigued by the possibilities there, and going, TV was ABC, NBC, CBS, and here I'm working for a company that was offering people in Manhattan 17 channels. Hmm. And I'm going, wow, that's kind of cool. I wish I lived in Manhattan and I could get all those channels and stuff. So I just started playing with stuff in my head, and the folks in the technical side, started to come to me and they go, hey, kid, how do you know how to use all the equipment in just a week? And usually it takes people a year to learn how to use it. And I'm like, well, I read the instruction booklet. I mean, it wasn't rocket science. And so I moved from being an assistant splicer to a splicer And then they moved me to become a construction guy, where instead of going to the sewers, I climbed through the backyards. And then I became an installer and then a serviceman. So very quickly, I worked my way literally out of the underground. And I was doing that. And then what happened was Time Incorporated, which at that time, before it was Time Warner, there was Time Incorporated, was basically a publishing company. You know, they bought the company and you had all the Harvard and Yaleys, you know, sitting up on Sixth Avenue. And, you know, a lot of them were trying to figure out, like, what is this company we bought? What do those guys do when they go underground? And then somebody in HR said, wait a second, there's a guy with an economics degree there. So I became kind of a translator between those two worlds. And it was great, you know, because when you're in the union, you get overtime and stuff. And, you know, I said, wow, I made $90 a week. Let me see if I can get to 100. Let me see if I get to 110. And so I put in a lot of hours there because I wanted to, you know, enjoy the fruits of my labor. It was actually funny because there was a big union contract that was coming up. And, you know, so here you had these union guys and they were going to have to go into a negotiating room against all these, you know, Harvard and Yaleys. And the shop steward said to me, he goes, hey, kid, we're going to put you on the negotiating committee because you know how to read and write. And I was like, yeah, but I don't know anything about, you know, negotiating union contracts. But anyway, they put me on the committee and we ended up negotiating a pretty good contract for, you know, back then. The union guys came to me and said, well, we really like, you know, having you there. And so they made me the vice chairman of the cable TV workers.
Nice.
I was 23 years old and I'm like, really?
Moving up in the world.
you know, so that was crazy. I mean, because it wasn't just Manhattan Cable. And I was like the vice chairman of the division for all the cable workers in the electrical workers union. Yeah. But then kind of a guy named Nick Nicholas, who was like one of the rising stars in the Timing family, got put into Manhattan Cable as the president. And he and I related to each other pretty quick. And, you know, again, I served that role as translator, you know, because he could talk to me about, you know, bottom line and reading, you know, financials and all that kind of stuff. And he kept asking me to go into management, which I was like, no, I'm not doing that, you know, because you can't fire me. I'm a union official. You can't fire me even if you wanted to. But finally, after a while, they convinced me. So I left the union, joined management. And at 25, they made me the director of operations in Manhattan. So now I had like all the things that I used to work for now reported to me. And I'm 25 and I have 300 and something people reporting to me, all of which were older, which created an interesting dynamic, you know, trying to manage that. And that was, you know, there were issues at times where people just weren't going to accept the kid. So I did that. And then Time Inc. really got involved in building. They wanted to become a media company as opposed to just a publishing company. So they started buying up a lot of stuff. I mean, we were part of the group that started HBO and Cinemax and
Wow. All
of that stuff. Then they made me the director of corporate development. We bought this very big company out of Denver called ATC and then became the biggest cable operator in the country back then. They then moved me from director of operations in Manhattan to becoming the director of corporate development, whose job it was to think of non-entertainment uses of the cable plant. So this is pre-internet. So basically, we were experimenting with what then became very common during the internet days, but literally 10 years before the internet existed. I was doing remote medical diagnostics and data communications and telephony and security systems and stuff all over the same wire that, you know, CNN was going over. And so it was a great upbringing because I got to learn the whole business there literally by doing every aspect.
Well, you're obviously a visionary because you're sitting there in a safe job. You got a pension, you're in the union, you know, the whole deal. And most folks are not moving, right? They're good where they are, but you went in the complete opposite direction, right? So was there a specific moment where you knew, nope, this isn't for me, I need to take a different path? Tell me about that transition from that security, that safe blanket to, oh, let me go the complete opposite way.
You know, I was, like I say, a union official and you know, I kind of had the life, but quite honestly, I looked at the management there. And, you know, I was going, I could do that. So, yeah, they asked me to leave the union and go into management a few times. And I said no. And then finally, I said, you know what? I'm 25 years old. I got a chance of adjusting. If I made a mistake, I'll just fix it and adjust it and stuff. So, yeah, so I jumped over at that age. And because I looked at what was in management and I said, you know, I can do all of that stuff. So it really wasn't a very big decision.
And so how was that transition? So tell me the journey between where you're working for someone to actually developing your own network. And how did that, was there anything in between, or did you just go from that phase to starting your own?
No, well, it was, you know, cable at that point was still, you know, basically for rural, and it was for bringing people good reception. Manhattan Cable was the anomaly in that it was really the first and only big city system that was out there. And, you know, again, because of all the tall buildings, you had to have cable to get reception, TV reception there. So that was the biggest cable system in the country. But then kind of around 1980, you know, you start to see things like CNN started and MTV started and ESPN, and all the big cities realized that cable TV was something that they wanted in their city, and it was more than just good reception. So they started issuing franchises. But most of the big cities didn't want the cables to go on telephone poles anymore because they were unsightly. They wanted the cables to go underground. Well, there was a Canadian company that won the franchise for Los Angeles. But the caveat was it had to be underground. Well, the only one around that knows how to build underground cable systems was me. So I was getting recruited by a lot of cities. And then finally, the guy from the Canadian company, the chairman of the company, said, hey, we want you to come out and interview you. And I go, look, I'm a Brooklyn kid. I ain't going to La La Land. You know? I said, that ain't happening. And finally, you know, after like 2 months, he called back and said, okay, listen, do you have a girlfriend? I went, yeah. And he goes, I fly you and your girlfriend out to L.A. I put you in the Bel Air Hotel. You'll have a car for the weekend. And you got to give me an hour. I went, as long as you understand that there's no way that I'm going to take that job. He goes, yeah, okay. So anyway, so I went out to L.A. And it was a company that's called Valley Cable, which was the whole San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I went out there and I was just an ass, quite honestly. I was like, okay, your hour starts now. You know, you got 50 minutes left, 40 minutes left, 2 minutes, you know. And then finally at the end, he goes, well, what would it take for you to move out here? And I said, really nothing. I said, he goes, no, but like, what would it take? I said, okay. So I just made up stuff that I figured there's no way they could possibly say yes to. It was like four times what I'm making in New York. I found out that Liberace, I don't know if you remember Liberace.
Yeah, of course.
Liberace had a big house here with a piano-shaped swimming pool that he moved to Las Vegas. I said, I want you to rent Liberace's house for me. I want a car with a mobile phone. And, you know, the guy said, you're out of your mind. And I went, exactly. Your hour's up. Goodbye. And so I went back to New York. And, you know, it was winter. And I'm going, boy, California was kind of nice. That weather was kind of good. And I like Mexican food. And, you know, and the guy calls up and I get a message. He goes, okay, listen, what you asked for is crazy, but here's what we could offer you. And they basically offered me twice what I was making in New York. And, you know, like an idiot, I said, listen, I wasn't negotiating. You asked me what it would take. I told you and goodbye. And I hung up. 2 weeks later, I'm like going to work. And, you know, in the winter Manhattan, when it snows, it's very pretty the first day.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But that becomes black gook.
Yeah, I live there. I know. It's the slush.
So I'm walking, you know, to the office and a cab goes by and splatters me with like black mud. And I'm going, boy, California's looking really good. And I get to the office and, you know, the assistant says to me, oh, that guy called again. I call him back. I go, yeah, what do you want? He goes, what you asked for is totally crazy, but yeah, how fast can you be here? And now I had my foot in my mouth. So that was it. So I left Manhattan and went there and built Valley Cable, which is the first two-way interactive cable system ever built. And at that time, it was the biggest cable system in the country. But now, not only do I have all the operating departments, but I now have finance and marketing and programming. And, you know, you're a Brooklyn kid, and you see everybody in L.A. is going to parties and premieres and going to all this, you know, Hollywood stuff. And I'm going, I want to do that. And I called the studios and they said, ah, you're like the telephone company. You're a utility. No. And they wouldn't give it. So I finally got a marketing guy. And I said, listen, the most effective vehicle you have for marketing a movie is a movie trailer. I said, but the only time I ever see a movie trailer is when I'm already in the movies. I said, wouldn't you want me to see that when I'm in my house to make me want to go to the movies? And they said, yeah, but, you know, the problem is it's too expensive and they have 2 minutes on television. I said, okay, tell you what, you give me the movie trailers, I'll put them on TV, you put me on those party lists. And they said, yeah, sure. So they did that, and, you know, I had to get to edit them together. But when we started doing market surveys, you know, what's your favorite channel? They go, oh, I love CNN and ESPN, and I love that trailer channel. And I'm going, gee, that's kind of odd. I get the best 2 minutes of a $50 million movie. Then it was only 50 for free, and people love it. And I kind of filed that in the back of my head. Well, the Canadian company eventually sold out, and they went back to Toronto. And they were like, all right, Larry, you're going to come to Toronto. And I went, no, no, no. I said, I didn't go from New York to L.A. to go to Toronto. I said, I'm done with cold. I don't want to be cold ever again. So my friend Alan, who came from New Jersey, we were just, you know, he kicking around ideas, said, let's think of something to keep us in L.A. And he goes, I don't know. He goes, I've been playing with this idea, you know, MTV of the movies. And I'm going, wait a second. I go, MTV, then when they did show music videos, they would have a host in front of a green screen and go, and, you know, Madonna has a new video. And I go, Alan, we could put a host in front of a green screen and we'll go and Schwarzenegger has a new movie. I said, we could get the movie trailers for free the same way they get all those music videos for free. So we thought we were really smart. So it was MTV and the movies or Entertainment Tonight 24 hours a day. We wrote a plan. We thought we were brilliant. You know, at that point, the going cost to start a TV network somewhere between $60 and $100 million, and we wrote the plan, and very naive we said, okay, let's go out and get the money. And 3.5 years later, when nobody gave us a dime, we finally met a guy on Wall Street whose company just moved from being a bond house to an investment banking company. And, you know, we go in his office and he's got movie posters all over the wall. And Alan and I are looking at each other going, this is strange. And, you know, a young guy, and he goes, oh, you know, I love this. I used to be the entertainment reporter for my college newspaper. And yes, I want to do it. And we're going, great. Could you make it more like the 100 million so we could do all the things we really want? He goes, oh, no, 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 no. He goes, I'm only allowed to sign for 2.5. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do with 2.5? I mean, the entry point is 60. He goes, well, all I could do is sign for 2.5. I went, Alan and I looked at each other and said, you know what? Nobody's giving us 60 or 100. We just said, fine, we'll do 2.5. And I had a friend that was teaching radio, television, film at the University of Texas in Austin. And I called him up and I said, well, I need, how many kids that need intern jobs? And he goes, yeah, we had a lot of trouble placing people. So he sent us 31 kids from Texas for the summer. Uh-huh. And what people don't realize, because he is it's a monster now, 142 countries. And but he started with 11 employees and 31 interns and went from the 2.5 million to, I don't know, it's up around 7 billion now or something like that.
How do you start something like that? So you have 2.5 million. Obviously, the entry point is 60 million. You have a business plan. You still have to get on the air. You still have to, probably there's a bunch of loopholes and ass kissing that you got to do. Tell me about that, the struggles on actually getting the network up. And how was that first show? What was that first show?
Sure. Well, we first started doing the movie trailers. Because, again, MTV of the movies was, you know, it was very easy to get the trailers you got for free, very economical to have a host in front of a green screen, you know, talking about the trailers that are coming. So we figured out how to slice and dice that. So, you know, you had the general coming this weekend and then the foreign films and the horror films. So we just broke it up into all these categories. But the thing that we did really good and really smart, you know, in looking back is, we said, you know what, with limited amount of money, we got to figure out how to maximize what we've got. I said, we're never going to dazzle anybody with fancy production values for that. I mean, we didn't even have enough money to buy like real TV equipment. We found some company selling off the equipment they were using to make their sales training tapes. So it was very piratey looking, which turned out to be good. But we said, you know, with a limited amount of money, the thing that we really can affect is we could pick hosts that people are going to feel something about. And, you know, a lot of people said to me, they go, oh, you were so lucky you had all those great hosts at the beginning. I mean, we had Greg Kinnear and Julie Moran went on to do Wide World of Sports. And Katie Wagner did Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Mark DiCarlo went on to do Studs. That was not an accident. To get those first five hosts, we interviewed almost 10,000 people.
Wow.
And we put 7,200 people on tape to get those first five. You know, and looking back, we go, that really changed it because people, and again, Alan and I had this attitude like Hollywood, it's not rocket science. It should be fun. You know, people come home from work and they want to sit and have a beer and it should be something you can go in and out of. You don't have to make a lifelong commitment to watching a series and stuff like that. So we started out with the movie trailers. And then as soon as it went on the air, people were like, oh my God, that's what you wanted to do. We would have given you money 3 years ago, which probably was not true, but that's what everybody was saying. And the audience reaction was fabulous. They go, hey, we feel like we're watching something that we're not supposed to. It's like, you know, we're going, yeah, you know, we didn't have enough money for real equipment. So it did look very pirate and it wasn't, you know, polished for the sake of polish. It was pretty raw. But, you know, then when we got a little bit of traction, we said, OK, let's start doing more traditional TV shows. So the first one that really was the breakthrough was Talk Soup. But, you know, again, not having money there. I mean, there's a lot to be said for that saying, necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
I mean, again, with no money, we said, OK, we're going to get the clips from these other shows and we're going to stand Greg Kinnear in front of a TV set and say and basically make fun of television shows. And, you know, the crew that, you know, a programming crew were going, Larry, you're out of your mind. You want to do a TV show that makes fun of TV shows? And I'm like, yeah, exactly. You know, because, you know, that was the time it was great. You had the Jerry Springers and, you know, all those shows then. And those people really, they were very smart. I got to say, Springer, when a lot of people were going, no, you know, you can't have my clips to make fun of. But Springer, on the other hand, was going, say good or bad, you're going to get new people to do it and help build his audience and stuff. So that really worked out. And then, you know, we went from there to we found this tall radio guy in a elevator in New York, actually. And it was like, oh, you got to come and watch my radio show. And we go, well, what do you mean watch your radio show? And, you know, we went and looked at it. And, you know, I went back to the team and said, okay, I want to put cameras in this guy's radio studio. And they were like, Larry, when you wanted to do like make fun of TV shows, we thought you're out of your mind. But now you're totally out of your mind. You know, that guy was Howard Stern, you know, and Howard obviously went on to do pretty well. But, you know, for me, it wasn't like a radio show. To me, it was a sitcom. There used to be an old sitcom in the U.S. called WKRP in Cincinnati.
Yep.
I go, he said, this is like a reality show. It's a comedy. And obviously, Howard did well. And then, you know, and then the rest were, you know, E! Hollywood True Story and Wild on E! And stuff like that. So once we had money, we started to really build it out and expand it.
So Talk Soup was actually probably, if I remember correctly, was probably the first show that I've seen on E! But it wasn't called E! Initially, right? It was called a different
name. It was called Movie Time, originally Movie Time. And then we changed the name. You know, we came with the slogan, you know, where America watches Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to be all the things that MTV wasn't. So we said, let's just claim it all other than music. And so we changed the name from Movie Time to E.
So you had to have had some real moments where, because there weren't that many stations like there are today, but there were enough that you could have got lost really easily without anybody watching, right? So there must have been many times where you were on the bathroom floor sucking your thumb in fetal position, not knowing if you have to go back to Brooklyn and work as a splicer again. Do you recall some of those times and what lessons you learned?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was people were just there never was a TV network that was just started by people as opposed to media companies. Mm-hmm. And I think even to this day, you don't have any of the TV networks that ever started by a person. And it was Alan and I. So, yeah, there was a lot. I mean, getting people to recognize us for being a valid thing. You know, we were the outliers. You know, a lot of the other programmers were rooting for our demise. I mean, particularly MTV, which we actually turned into a positive for us because I love sticking them in the butt with a pin, and they would react to it. I mean, for example, we started running things on the network, on TalkSoup, going, and here's a thing that's on that that music channel, whatever it's called. And what's the M stand for? Oh, it's your mother's TV. Yeah. And they would just get so angry that we would literally make fun. I mean, we just attacked them. And finally, the president of MTV told his ad sales group, said, listen, you go out and you tell all the advertisers that if they do anything with this dumb network, this E network or Movie Time at that time, they're not going to get enjoy their discounts anymore. And, you know, he had an army of like 30 people who would go around all the ad agencies going, now you can't work with those Movie Time guys. And people going, Movie Time, what's that? If MTV's worried about it, maybe we should find out. So they actually spread the word for us, you know, and got it out there. But yeah, no, at the beginning, we applied for credentials to go to the Oscars mm-hmm. and cover the Oscars, and they refused us. They said, hey, you're some dumb little cable network. No, not being smart enough to take no for an answer. We literally climbed over the fence and snuck into the Academy Awards, and we were on the red carpet for about a half an hour before security caught us and threw us out. But then when people saw the footage, you know, and our stuff was different, you know, then it was still the days of, so, Tom Cruise, tell us about your next movie. You know, we were like, whoa, Tom, where'd you get those shoes? Those are like really cool. And people would go, oh, my God, that was like so cool. We felt like we were watching something we weren't supposed to. And we were like, yeah, okay. But that kind of, you know, it set the tone. It set that attitude. It was like we had a sensibility that people weren't used to seeing on television.
So that's, being scrappy is obviously, that was the name of the game. But if you had to really call out a trait or two for an entrepreneur, for you and your partner, to make this a successful network when no one believed in you in the beginning, nobody wanted to invest in you in the beginning, everybody thought that you're going to be done very quickly, what were some of the traits that you had to embody and perfect that other entrepreneurs could focus on if they want to become successful?
Well, it was, you know, we were very good with self-assessing. So we would come up with, you know, all these ideas in the morning, and by nighttime we go, those are pretty dopey, let's not do those. But we were very honest and genuine with ourselves. We go, you know what, seemed like a good idea this morning, dumb, next. And so we didn't waste a lot of time. A lot of people get caught up on this passion thing. Well, it's my idea and I'm passionate about whatever. And, you know, the thing that we all have as people, as human beings, we have a finite amount of time on this planet. You know, some of us have a little longer than others, but that's our valuable asset at the end of the day. And if you spend it following your passion and your passion can't really get to something. So I think the thing we did, we didn't take ourselves that seriously. And we didn't think ourselves, you know, we just said, you know what, it seemed like a good idea, but it's not, next. And we would move very quickly from thing to thing. And we weren't afraid to try stuff, you know, where everybody was kind of in that, you know, the celebrity world, you know, the Entertainment Tonight's, they were very serious. They were, you know, kind of thought they were like curing cancer and stuff like that. And our sensibility was totally different. I mean, we were just like, Hollywood is funny stuff. Don't make believe it's anything more than that. And that really came across. I mean, because it presented something to these audiences that was so different. I mean, we were really the first ones to be in the reality TV world, you know, where everybody kind of poo-pooed and said, oh, this is stupid and it's going to go away. Well, you know, here we are 30, 40 years later and it's not gone away. So we were very open to trying stuff. We didn't think it was rocket science. We really celebrated celebrity. We weren't like TMZ looking, so let's go catch someone cheating on their wife and we'll ruin their marriage and stuff like that. And, you know, it was all done in good spirit. And it was like, you know, people want to go to bed at night with a smile on their face thinking tomorrow is going to be a good day. And that's the way we approached it. And, you know, rather than watch bad news at 11 o'clock at night, they would watch us and, you know, they would go to bed with a smile.
All right, Larry, When was the first time that you looked in the mirror and you said, holy shit, I made it. I did something here.
It's funny because everybody expects me to say E. Financially, of course, E. But, you know, I look at that and people look at me in amazement. I go, okay, so Alan and I figured out that people around the world like Hollywood gossip. You know, to me, that's not a great revelation. I mean, we executed it very, very well. And we did a lot of really smart things. But, you know, some years later, I find myself in China. And I have a media company in China, which I think we're still the only Western media company that's allowed to operate as a media company there. So fooling around, I'm going, okay, let me find something real. Let me put myself in a spot that's really challenging. I said, so I've never written comedy in my life, sitcom. Let me write a sitcom and let me write it in China for, you know, a country that I didn't grow up in, for culture, I don't necessarily understand the language I don't speak. I said, that's kind of challenging. So I kind of wrote it and I gave it to our partner in Beijing, Chinese woman, Jean. And she goes, oh, I really like this. Could I take it to the TV station? I went, yeah, you know, okay. I didn't think anything would become of it. And, you know, she comes back and says, oh, I took it to the biggest national TV network there. And in China, the big national TV network reaches 1.1 billion people. And she says, and, you know, the guy loves it and he wants to meet the writer. So I arrange dinner. So we go to dinner and they come walking in. And I know enough Mandarin where I could tell the guy is going, no, I want to meet the writer. This is a white guy. And, you know, and I'm like, really, you think so? And he, you know, then he switches to English because he went to school in the U.S. and he spoke good English. He goes, no. He goes, I just, when I read it, I never thought it was written by anybody other than a Chinese person. He goes, but you're an American and we're Communist Party TV. We can't put this on television. I went, yeah, okay. You know, like 2 weeks later, the guy calls back and says, okay, I went to the propaganda department with it, which there is a propaganda department there. And they know who you are. And they said, if I want to do it, it's okay. So we end up having this sitcom on national television in China, and it goes 72 episodes. And then finally I stopped. I said, listen, guys, I can't be funny after 72. I'm done. But it ends up getting nominated at the Asia TV Awards in Singapore. And it's the only comedy from China that's nominated. And when I look back, I go, you know what? That's actually kind of cool. I've never written comedy in life. And, you know, here it is. We didn't win, but we're the funniest TV show in China. I said that I would never imagine in a million years.
Oh, that's awesome. I've asked this before, and I get interesting responses from those who become very successful. You obviously made probably your first million with E, and then there's multi-millions and potentially billion when you sold it. What's the difference in mindset, in fulfillment, in just your way of life? Your first million, getting to a point where money doesn't really matter much at that point.
It's when you reach the point where you could say, fuck you.
Yeah.
It's where you realize you don't have to do anything just because you need to pay the rent anymore. It's like you can pick and choose the things that you want to do. And you're not being guided by the money,
yeah,
but you're being guided by your heart and soul.
So what changes when that happens?
You could say F you to, you just turn away pride, where before, you know, somebody would come with a project and you'd say, oh, I got to take that because, you know, the kids need to eat and I got to pay the rent or, you know, the mortgage and whatever. Is when you realize you don't have to do that anymore. That you could say, you know what, nice idea, but not for me. And you go on and only do those things that you really feel are things that you want to do. And, you know, for whatever your, you know, agenda is for the future. And I'm the happiest person in the world because I wake up every day and I only do what I want to do. I don't have to do anything. So
in terms of fulfillment, right? Because you've achieved, but in terms of fulfillment, really waking up and being fulfilled, you said you're the happiest person in the world. How much of that has to do with just the pure success of the financial aspect and rewards? Or have you spent enough time while you grew E, et cetera, on family, on mindset, on spirituality, on all kinds of other aspects of your life?
Yeah. With E, it was very intense. So, you know, in looking back, I would say, boy, I wish I would have been able to spend a little more time with the family and the kids and whatever. But I'll tell you where the turning point was. And it was a really dramatic thing. When my oldest son, John, when he was 15, was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. And they said he's got this rare form of cancer and no kid has ever gone more than 6 months. And, you know, make your plans, but he ain't going to be there. Life changes. When your kid is faced with that, it's everything else becomes a blur. And, you know, the mission, I mean, him, his mom and I were not together at the time, but you know, we were still really good with the kids and everything. And it was just like, we're going to find the solution to John. So we literally scoured the world for stuff. And finally, we found an experimental program for that form of cancer being administered out of a hospital in New York. And we got John into the program, and yeah, he ended up being a little miracle kid. You know, he actually just celebrated his 20 years cancer free.
Wow. That's awesome.
And yeah, and but that changes it all. You everything falls into a whole different perspective, and you really begin to look at things, and you go, why would I let something like whatever, some business thing upset me? In the long run, what does it really mean? So for me, that was a turning point, a lot of stuff where I said, you know, I have to find and how to be much more active in the different buckets of my life as opposed to just focusing on business and nothing else. You know, family became more important. Taking care of myself physically became more important. Just everything else became, I realized you have to raise the level of importance to a whole bunch of things. It's not just making money.
What do you think about balance?
Well, I think it goes with kind of the purpose of your show is, yeah, you got to find balance and stuff, but it's more than just, it's not just this or that. I mean, there's a lot of different things in your life. You know, there's the business side, there's the family side, there's the relationship with, you know, your significant other, whoever that may be. There's just the taking care of yourself, just physically and spiritually. So you got to really figure out how you're going to really work with all those different aspects. It's not just one or two. It's a bunch.
Thank you for that. It's just fascinating. You have so much experience. You've been in the room with, especially as you grew, incredible investors, power players, especially in Hollywood. Probably some you thought were scum, probably some you respected. What's the secret to negotiating from a position of strength, even if you don't hold all the cards? Because initially, you didn't hold all the cards. And so what secrets do you have in terms of entrepreneurs who really want to get in the game, who really want to negotiate, who are meeting with folks who are above them in level, and they feel like they don't have the power? What do you say?
Well, I mean, you know, for me in particular, what I've always done is I use the symbol of Rupert Murdoch as the devil. And I mean, and again, that's, you know, kind of figuratively. But whenever I look at a project, I look at it and go, okay, what is Rupert Murdoch going to do when he finds out I'm doing this? Because he could bury me with money and people and stuff like that. So if I can't find that one thing that's going to make him look at it and go, oh man, I wish I would have thought of that before he, whatever that is, then I don't do it. Because I know he's going to do that to me. And then again, I don't mean Rupert per se. I mean all the big guys. So I always make sure I look and say, what's the real value here? Where is that value? Can I and how do I take it off the table? So by the time I walk in there, I've changed, even though they have more money and more power, I've changed the leverage. Mm-hmm.
And how, so in terms of having a strong team around you, how much of your success was because of what you brought to the table and how much was your success because of your team?
Oh, well, I think the fact that I built the team really does say something about me.
True.
But I've just always been where I don't care what the thing is. If I hire someone, they have to be better at it than I am. I mean, and that's kind of the thing. If I'm going to hire an editor, I don't want someone who I could edit better. They have to make me better by default there. So I just hire the smartest people. And this is not something that we've done with thought, but we, you know, now, you know, with our company, we're like 75% women because we just hire the smartest people. That's just the thing. We don't really care midgets or, you know, whatever. It's just, you got to be like super smart and you got to be smarter than me. We built this very interesting place. I mean, again, because we have more women in C-suite than what the national averages are. And it's because we just built an environment that a lot of women feel really good working in and they feel they're appreciated. So whenever job openings come, they bring their friends in like really quickly. So we've just kind of over time migrated that we're more women than men and stuff like that. And particularly in China, it's turned out to be really, really good for us.
How, did you sell E? What happened?
We sold it to Comcast.
So once you've done that, what are you doing now? Like, where did you take your talents?
Well, I was still at E. I started doing stuff in Russia, mainly as a favor to a lawyer friend of mine. And then I met the mayor of St. Petersburg, and he asked me to help him start a music festival to raise money for the children's hospital and the orphanage, which we did that. And I ended up working with the vice mayor of St. Petersburg on this charity event. And, you know, the guy just turns out to be Vladimir Putin.
I saw a picture of you and him.
Yeah, when he kind of went up the ladder and ended up in the Kremlin, they realized that in order to build a consumer economy, you had to have media that looked a little bit familiar to Western marketers because people are going to want to buy the Western luxury goods in particular. And so I worked with the Minister of Communications to kind of rewrite regulatory policy there so that, you know, when the Gucci's and the Prada's and everybody came in, it looked a little familiar to their marketing folks. And then when the Chinese kind of came to that same realization, they liked the Russian model because the Russian model was always, okay, here's the line that you shouldn't step across. So they went to the Russians. The Russians sent them to me. So I ended up going to China and working on that and teaching young television executives the process of creativity for profit. And then, you know, they asked us to start a little media company there so they could learn from us, which we did, and we still do. And in China, we do TV, film, internet content, immersive, live events, concerts, and all of that. But then when COVID came, I started doing stuff in the U.S. again, which I kind of swore off the U.S. because it's really become like three or four big companies control the whole thing. And I was not in the mood to start banging my head against the wall again. But with COVID, I said, okay, I got to start doing stuff. So we do stuff here in the U.S. Just about everything we do has to have a social impact component to it. So we did financial wellness for millennials and conscious parenting about being a parent in today's difficult environment. And we've got a late night talk show coming up with a woman host. There are no women in late night television in this country. We don't understand why, but we're bringing one. She's not promotional. She's motivational and inspirational. And again, after COVID, I think people want to go to bed with a smile. You know, there's enough bad news that you get all day long. Yeah. So we're doing that. Then we just got involved in the podcast world. We've got a podcast called Stalled Talk. And yeah, it's kind of another one of my odd ideas. You go out to dinner with a few couples and one woman says, I got to go to the restroom, and they all get up and go.
Yeah.
And the guys are sitting there going, where are they? What are they doing? But it really is about this camaraderie among women.
Yeah.
I don't think we as guys share. I mean, we'll talk about sports together, but we don't get into feelings and all of that kind of stuff. So Stone Talk is women of four different generations, and they'll examine, you know, issues, everything from the latest in makeup to, you know, what's going on in Washington and stuff. But you hear it from the different generations. So even though they may disagree with each other on stuff, you could still sense this underlying love and respect that women have for each other. So that's doing, it's only 3 months old and it's doing really, really well and stuff. And we're looking more and more podcasts. But the nice part about the podcast world is there's no gatekeepers.
Yeah.
And also so economical, you could take a lot of chances. And I mean, my frustration in this country is everything is big corporations.
Yeah, for sure.
When I go in with a new idea, people go, well, what's it like? And I'm going, it's not like anything. It's a new idea. You know? And with the podcast world, I can do proof of concept on stuff and show people that things work and stuff like that, and then move them to higher platforms if they need to move.
So these new shows that you're doing, the late night and all the other educational, is it on? Are you placing these folks on a network, or are you doing your own thing? Is it a...
No, no, those all go on other networks.
So you have to pitch the idea and then get on that network, and it's like the same. Got it. When you met Putin, how was he? And then the follow-up question would be like, did you have one person that, or a few people that you met that you were like, oh my God, I'm like so at awe with meeting these folks. They're just incredible.
Well, with Putin, again, he was the vice mayor of St. Petersburg when we met him. So he wasn't, he wasn't a good guy yet. But we got along really, really well because, you know, here I am helping raise money for the children in the city that he grew up in. So we were always fine. I mean, there was never any issues there. But then we were having a big, like a press conference in New York at the Russian Tea Room. And the mayor of St. Petersburg, Anatoly Sobchak, was supposed to come, but he wasn't feeling well. So he sent Putin. Hmm. And, when he was there, and it's still, when writing the book, it amazed me. I introduced Putin and Henry Kissinger.
Nice.
So, for me back then, meeting Henry Kissinger was like, wow. But now, kind of looking back and going, I can't believe I brought Putin to the U.S. and, stuff like that. So looking back, I do that. But no, I don't get starstruck at all.
You've been around those folks for a while. Is there a lot of entrepreneurs experience failure? I'm sure you have as well. Was there ever a time where you had a complete failure and you were distraught at that time, but it was really one of the best things that ever happened to you? And you're looking back, you'd be like, wow, I'm so glad that failure happened.
No, I'm never so glad that the failure happened. But back in the the heyday when the internet was really taking off, and domain names were selling for millions of dollars and stuff. I think in the late '90s, sex.com sold for like $8 million and stuff. Well, me and a group, we owned television.com.
Oh wow!
And we were offered like $7 million and. We're going like, well, do we look dopey if sex.com was, 8 million, television.com is worth 10 million. And we didn't sell it and we launched it. And we were doing one of the first to really do streaming video and stuff before the technology was really there.
Yeah.
So people move kind of like, robots. But when we launched it, the cost for advertising, people would pay $25 per 1,000 viewers roughly. And then the internet market collapsed. And, I had all these websites dumping inventory into there. So the price went from $25 to 25 cents. Mm. And because we had such a great domain name, people Google television or, and we would get 1 million viewers a month with spending no money. But because we were doing all this video, it was expensive. So every time someone used the channel, we would lose money. Because we were getting $25 a thousand, and it was costing us a dollar. And there was no way out of it. But what it taught me was that you really have to pay a lot more attention to changes in technology and changes in regulation and changes in economic environment, as well as changes in geography. I mean, I realized very early on that Hollywood, while it used to be the center of the production world, I mean, if you wanted to make anything visual, you had to come to Hollywood. You needed big sound stages and all of that. And cameras were $250,000. I mean, now I could take my cell phone and go to Nigeria tomorrow and make a movie on my iPhone.
Yep.
So it taught me to start paying attention to, even though it's a good idea, like what are the external factors? A, the ones that you control and plan for, and B, the ones that you're going to have no control of. How do you recognize them early? And cut your losses and get out.
Wow. Is there, my wife's an actress, Hollywood actress. She's been around for 30 years now in the business. So I'm familiar. But in the entertainment world, there's a lot of myths out there about what success looks like. And I think you're the perfect person to ask because you've seen it from the media side, from the talent side. Is there a misunderstanding or a myth about making it in Hollywood or in media that you've seen?
Well, I still see a lot of people out here, following their passion and stuff like that. And I look at these things and, oh, I'm making a movie about spoons, you know, because I'm passionate about spoons. And I'm going, yeah, but, you know, how passionate about paying your rent next month and stuff like that. People don't really think of the realities of life still and stuff. And, you know, every pretty girl in the world is told, oh, you got to come to Hollywood and you'll be an actress. And, you know, at best they're waitresses and, you know, they're the prettiest girl in school. And here you come out here and there's 10,000 of the prettiest girls in school. And, you know, it's a tough road. It's just, you really have to, A, not just be good, but you have to have the work ethic. And again, I think work ethic is something that's interesting. I get people all the time coming to me because we've developed a heck of a lot of hosts at E. You know, you think of all the talk soup hosts that have gone on to bigger and better things. Mm-hmm. And people come to me to say, oh, I want you to help me. I want to be a host. I want to have a talk show. And the conversation would typically go, okay, you've got the personality. Okay. But I said, do you realize what it means to be a host of a daytime talk show? You're going to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're going to get into hair and makeup. At 5 o'clock to 11 o'clock, you're going to shoot. You're going to go home. You're going to have lunch. You're going to go to sleep. And you're going to do it 50 weeks a year. And then Barry was, oh, no, no, I can't do that. I mean, I don't wake up at three. Can we get them to move it? No. You know, I spend the summers in the Hamptons. I can't do 50 weeks a year. So finding all the pieces is there. And like I say, a lot of people come here without understanding the work ethic. People who are celebrities or producers that have made it, it's not by accident and it's not just based on talent. It's the whole work ethic. It's the talent, the work ethic, and a little bit of luck.
I think the thing is, entrepreneurship is one of the hardest professions, I think, in the world, most demanding, and it will beat your ass up. But I think acting or being in the business might be worse than that, because you're talking about, for instance, my wife. She goes up for a role. She might be the best damn actress in the world, but there's another 50 incredible actors. How do they pick the casting director, the director? How do they pick who they ultimately go with? And then you have the other 50 who are just as qualified getting the no. It's such a brutal business, really brutal.
Yep, that it is.
Yeah. Is there a misconception about you that you wish you would correct, you could correct? Is there someone, is there anything that people see you and are like, oh, Larry, that?
Yeah, people, you know, there's this reverence that, you know, I get, you know, people, oh my God, the founder of E. You know, E wasn't always, you know, E then was not the E today. I mean, yeah, now 142 countries, arguably the biggest influence of pop culture in the world. But I'm still the guy from Brooklyn. But, you know, they expect me to be more presidential or, you know, whatever you want to call it and stuff. That's just not me. You know, I don't do that. I don't relish in the Hollywood glory days and stuff like that. So.
Oh, that's great. All right. Two questions and then I'll let you go. I know you're extremely busy. So we have something in big in common. You built a billion-dollar business. That's not me. Not yet. But we both love cooking. Right. And I know for you, it's more than just making food. It's a passion. Has cooking been a form of therapy? What is it about the process that keeps you back? Tell us a little bit about that, your passion of cooking, because you put it in the book, which is
interesting. Yeah. And it's actually one of the reasons I finally agreed to write the book. I've literally been cooking since I'm 12. My parents both worked, and my choice was learn how to cook or eat peanut butter and jelly for dinner every night. So I did it and I liked it and I started reading my mother's cookbooks and doing that. And I got better. I have a knack for it. But over time, I found that cooking really is therapy for me. I mean, I could have the worst day, but I could go in the kitchen and just for 2 hours, it's that process of cutting and and cooking and plating and stuff like that. It just takes my mind off of whatever it was. And by the time I get back to work, it's whatever was bothering me then, just, you know, going, okay, why did I let that get to me? And, you know, so everybody in Hollywood goes to psychiatrists and psychologists and does that, or they go to hot yoga and stuff. I go in the kitchen and cook, and that serves the purpose. That's my therapy, is cooking.
I'm eyeing your chicken parm. Is there a dish that's your signature dish that you love cooking most?
Well, you know, what amazes people, when I was in college, I ended up getting a job in a delivery of a Chinese restaurant in New York. Because in New York, everybody does takeout. And so I would go in the kitchen, I pick up the bags, and I bring them to people's houses. But I was always fascinated with cooking, so I would always ask the cooks, teach me how to make egg rolls, teach me how to make the spare ribs and stuff. So I learned how to cook Chinese food there. And then there was a Chinese New Year party that was supposed to happen, but there was a snowstorm in New York, and three of the cooks didn't make it to work. And the head chef just pointed at me, he goes, you got to help us cook. So I ended up cooking in a Chinese restaurant, which, you know, I can cook Chinese food as literally as good as anybody on the planet now and stuff. And that's the one that always amazes people, is the Chinese food. And you know, in New York, we grew up with real egg rolls, not spring rolls. And yep. And on the West Coast, you don't find egg rolls and stuff. But unless you come to my house, I know how to make them.
Nice. And so your recipes on your Chinese recipes are authentic recipes in the book.
You do they're authentic in the sense that they're really a lot of it like Cantonese. Like old Cantonese. There's this cuisine that kind of goes from Boston down to Philadelphia, which I call it New York Chinese food, mm-hmm. which is, you know, 100 years of people like my mother going to the Chinese restaurant going, this is a good dish, but you should put peas in it. So the food has been, it's really Cantonese food, Southern Chinese, that's been bastardized over, you know, 150 years. And it's really become a cuisine that if you grew up there, that's your impression of Chinese food. You don't find it anywhere unless you come to my house and I cook it for you. So,
I'm sure it's absolutely delicious. So, I like to close out my interviews with the following question for everybody: who did you have to stop being, and who did you need to become to manifest your current success?
Yeah. Well, I had to stop being, you know, a little street tough guy from Brooklyn, you know, because I grew up in Coney Island and, you know, fighting was like something we did. And, you know, and I realized that when I got into management, somebody did something wrong, I wasn't allowed to punch them. So it was really getting, you know, kind of taking that Brooklyn out of me and becoming a little more like a corporate leader mm-hmm. and stuff. And you know, I had two very good mentors at Manhattan Cable. One was a guy named Frank Chiano, who was the vice president of operations. So he was the guy I reported to. You know, and again, when I started, I was 17 layers down, but I eventually reported directly to him. He was not your typical college educated, whatever, but he rose to a high position. So he was the one I could relate to the most. And then when Time Inc. came in and Nick Nicholas became the president, Nick ended up becoming the president of Time Warner. After the merger, I mean, he went all the way up the ladder. He really instilled in me these corporate disciplines. He had to think like a Harvard or Yale and stuff like that, how to analyze business opportunities and coming up with strategic plans. So I was very fortunate to get two people very different to kind of be my inspirations and my mentors at that time.
Larry, never follow the crowd. Recipes for success. I'm holding up Larry's book here. Everyone should go and buy it. It's really fascinating. Your story is awesome. It's not even a long read. It's a pretty quick book. Got a bunch of recipes in the back, so you can go out, read it, and make some food. What do you want the Seven Hatters to know about you? And do you want them to contact you? What is it that you want them to know?
Well, people wanted me to write the book for years, and I wouldn't do it until I realized that we could segment my life into like these 7-year periods.
Yep.
So the book is this combination between bio and cookbook. So we break my life into my Brooklyn years, my Manhattan Cable years, my Valley Cable years, my Russia years, Camille years. And so it's the anecdotes of those periods of my life match with the recipes that inspired me during that time. So it's an odd book and stuff. And it is a quick read, and it's these short little anecdotes and stuff. And some of the stuff you read, and even for me in writing it, I had to think of all the stuff that I haven't thought about in decades. You know, and I'm going, I can't believe I was fighting with O.J. Simpson. we were going to beat each other with baseball. But, you know, just all this very weird stuff. So when you read, it's all true. Everything you read in the book is true. And some of it seems like, oh, my God, this couldn't really be happening. So
how long did it take you to write the book? Because I'm writing a book right now, and I know how difficult and time consuming it is.
Writing the book was about 3 months. But I got to say, well, I've learned that marketing a book is a lot harder than writing the book. It's so intense and stuff. And, you know, you got to start with like these little sales, you know, these 2 and 3 and 4 sales a day, and you work your butt off to get those until you get to a point where the book clubs and stuff begin to notice. I mean, if you're looking at selling the book, you got to get to the book clubs and the people who can buy hundreds of copies. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, you're going to be doing social media and, you know, just getting out a few little things a day. And but it's kind of fun learning the process and stuff, and learning the algorithms and social media. You got to really pay attention to all this new stuff. And it's been, I don't know if I'd ever do it again, but it's kind of been fun doing it.
Well, Larry, it's always a pleasure and an honor to speak with someone who has shaped pop culture, society, the way people even behave on a day-to-day basis. Honored to meet you. Thank you so much for gracing us on the Seven Hats and sharing some incredible stories that are just fascinating. I could probably speak with you for another week in just getting into your brain and all the experiences that you've had. But I really appreciate your busy guy taking the time to speak with us and help the Seven Hatters learn a little bit more about you. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Larry. Let's end today with a show segment that I refer to as What Can We Hang Our Head On? And here is my takeaway. Let's reflect on Larry's extraordinary journey and the invaluable lessons that we can learn from his remarkable story. In the challenging landscape of entrepreneurship, Larry's evolution from Brooklyn cable splicer to global media pioneer exemplifies what's possible when you combine vision with relentless determination. Through Larry's experiences, we're reminded of the transformative power of seeing opportunities others miss. When he recognized the potential of movie trailers as content, while everyone else viewed them as merely promotional materials, he wasn't just being creative. He was fundamentally reimagining what entertainment could be. Larry's story also emphasizes the importance of servant leadership in Hat 6, the philanthropist. Whether raising money for children's hospitals in Russia or creating content that makes people go to bed with a smile, his work has consistently served audiences and communities in meaningful ways. His approach teaches us that true impact comes from asking how we can serve others, not just how we can profit. Perhaps most powerfully, his philosophy of transforming himself every 7 years, from cable operations to network founder to international media executive to author, shows us that entrepreneurship isn't just about building one successful venture. It's about continuous evolution. The turning point in Larry's story when his son faced terminal cancer reminds us that true success must be measured across all aspects of life, not just business achievement. His reflection that you have to find balance and attend to the different buckets of life is something every entrepreneur needs to hear, and it's the core of the Seven Hats philosophy. So, as we bid farewell today, let us carry Larry's story with us as inspiration, a reminder that success comes not from following the crowd, but from charting your own course with creativity, resilience, and a commitment to continuous reinvention. I want to thank Larry once again for joining me so that we can all benefit from his wisdom. And if you found this episode helpful, please hit that subscribe button and tell other entrepreneurs out there what value you receive from it so that we can attract even more high-quality people into our Seven Hats community. So for now, I will bid you farewell and success on your journey. And until next time, my name is Yuval Selick, and I tip my hat to you.